Now, another of the very important points in your monographs, V.D., concerns the some steps taken by Germany beyond promoting ethnic friction in places like the former Yugoslavia and Slovakia. They have actively moved to, or elements of the German government have actively moved to frustrate civil liberties and human rights provisions in the constitution of the EC.
Yes, they have. Before we get to that, let us please finish with one slight point on the intelligence gathering.
Sure.
The Goethe Institute, if you're, part of this is anecdotal, but any of your listeners who have attended a function of the Goethe Institute, whether in the United States or in Europe, will see that the people were very friendly, but were very inquisitive also. The visitor is made to feel very important, and their name, their address, what they do for a living, what their views are about this and that, as if Germans were really interested in hearing opinions of inferior creatures, you know. But so that there at every post of Goethe Institute are always day-in, day-operatives who are working and finding out information on the people who come there and who visit. They do this in Eastern Europe, in Prague. They have on every Thursday afternoon, they have a sort of TGIF on a Thursday at which the main movers and shakers of Czech society are invited. And the day-in, day have their operatives there to listen, to speak with them, and to report back. The point here is that one has to get to know the German beehive to understand how closely together are the workings of the propaganda forces of Goethe Institute and cultural, and the political motions by the Auswärtiges Amt and the foreign minister, and the intelligence gathering services, and German large core companies who are at the core of the fascist corporatist hegemony, as well as the major German banks on whose boards they sit. That is, that German bankers sit on the boards of the major companies in such a way and help determine their policies, and they co-determine each other's policies. They are very inbred. And this sort of commercial and political and cultural and intelligence gathering incest is something we hardly consider in other European countries, let alone in the United States.
And indeed, it really goes to the very essence of what Adolf Hitler meant and put into practice as National Socialism.
It is the essence of fascism, particularly.
Mm-hmm.
Is working together in a beehive. And this corporatist philosophy is one thing that I wanted to give you a book by a Californian, by Professor Angelo Codevilla, C-O-D-E-V-I-L-L-A, Codevilla.
Who's right down the road, incidentally, at the Hoover Institute.
That is correct.
Next town over. Go ahead.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Is that close to you?
Yes, it is.
I've never been. I'm not that familiar. He wrote a book called Informing Statecraft. Informing Statecraft.
Mm-hmm.
Published in 1992 by Maxwell Macmillan.
Right.
And his point is that the Germans will continue to maintain a large intelligence gathering network throughout Eastern Europe, even after, and the Baltic, even after the long after the collapse of communism, when it otherwise would not be necessary, and that intelligence operations will permeate all public and private fields of endeavor. And life in Eastern Europe and the Baltic will be more complicated and uncertain than is healthy because of that German espionage presence.
One of the things that, of course, the only time I had ever come across Codevilla's name was in connection with a legal opinion that he wrote, which was cited by the principals in the Iran-Contra affair to justify violating the Boland Amendment. One of the things that I have noted for my audience over the years is that when fascism really is on the march, many true conservatives, and I don't think enough progressives, at least in America, distinguish between a true conservative and a fascist, and it's an important distinction, but that many true conservatives will take up the banner of anti-fascism when they see what's really going on. I know next to nothing about Codevilla. It does surprise me to see that observation in his book. What can you tell us, digressing briefly, about Codevilla and how he would see something like this?
I'm afraid you would have to speak with him.
Okay.
First of all, it is probably a legitimate question as to whether he is a political scientist, and I believe that you might see him writing from a scientific viewpoint,
mm-hmm.
and therefore, in one issue, he would emphasize certain points objectively, and in other issues, he might take a different, where reasonable minds might differ, in mm-hmm. other words. That's part of the game of being a scientist, I believe.
Okay.
And he has that liberty. Thank God he can write what he wants to. In the United States, still in Germany, he wouldn't get by with it for very long and keep his job.
All righty. Well, by the way, we're going to talk about the German cartels, and I have focused on not only the German cartels, but their massive connections to American corporations, how that led...
Do you intend to speak about the German influence on American society through such things as, let's say, their managerial techniques, for example, which are fascinating in and of themselves?
Well, let's get to that, because that's something that you know much more about than myself. I've talked about the historical role and the connections mm-hmm. between German companies such as IG Farben and powerful American corporations, how that led to actual hands-on American industrial and political support for the rise of fascism in Germany. But as we talk about German policy vis-a-vis Eastern Europe, the former Soviet Union, and Europe in general, one of the fascinating points in one of your monographs, Willy, concerned German efforts to frustrate human rights and civil liberties provisions being set forth for the EC. Could you go into that for us?
Well, let's say that they try to frustrate other people's efforts at stability and democracy in Eastern and Western Europe. It's merely because the European community is a dynamic, integrated organization at all that it comes to German attention. If you are there and you have an organization that protects civil rights, then sooner or later you will get undermined by their efforts. In Eastern Europe, for example, the German efforts are to show that all the consultants and all the advisors to the Czech government, the Hungarian government, the Polish government, that these people are all they're all unqualified, and they're all delegitimated, and they're all discredited by snooping and delving. And I don't care who they are. They can be anyone from an American company, from an American university. Sooner or later, it will show up in the German press that people of this sort are not doing the Czech Republic any good, are not doing Hungary any good. They should take more German executives, more German advisors. It is a form of cultural arrogance that perpetuates a myth of Teutonic superiority. As far as the European Commission is concerned, we saw that not very long ago there had been a trend by the European Court of Justice, which takes care of interpreting and enforcing provisions for human rights and civil liberties contained in the Treaty of Rome and in the treaties that followed the Treaty of Rome, which are wrapped up into the European Commission. There are efforts in Europe to standardize and to make uniform civil rights and civil liberties for equal protection under the law throughout the European community nations. Recently, the German labor minister, Norbert Blüm, for some odd reason decided that he had had enough of this judicial activism on the part of the European Court of Justice, and said that if we are going to have any kind of regional integrity in the European community, we cannot afford to have a court someplace outside Germany telling us what we Germans have to do to protect other people's civil rights. So that all these tenets of the European community that the Germans had claimed to be the best citizens in Europe, and now we are saying through the labor minister, not through the chancellor, he sent out his furry friend, the labor minister, to say this very unpopular thing to say, I'm afraid that we're going to have to review financially the activities of the European Court of Justice. Now, if you want to read a threat into this, it is a threat, it's eine Drohung, that if they continue to exercise their prerogatives as the Supreme Court of Europe in civil rights, and to standardize rights for people all over Europe, then they will come under a financial review and financial scrutiny. And then the Germans, who pay for everything with their own checkbook, will have to determine, do we wish to continue to put money out for this sort of nonsense that is protecting Italians and Spanish but is not protecting Germans?
By the way, the source cited in your monograph is an interview in Der Spiegel in December of 1992.
Which monograph was that?
This is, let me find the beginning, this is part four, this in synopsis, which you've entitled The Role of Regional Transnational Cooperation in East European and Baltic Economic and Political Development. That's in number four.
Yeah. Right, okay, I have fetched number four.
Oh.
Thank you.
Okay. And by the way, Lily, wherever you would like to do so, feel free to do what I do at my archive shows, to extract directly text, either reading it in the native language and then translating it for us, wherever you feel that would be helpful, please do so, because obviously in this country people do not have access to this information, so it's vital to get that.
One of the other adjuncts to what we had discussed before, that where there is an intentional undermining of other people's efforts, such as Norbert Blüm, the Arbeitsminister, the Labour Minister, criticizing the European Court of Justice and threatening to cut off their money if they continue with this act, this terrible thing of giving everyone equal rights, what a terrible, terrible anti-fascist idea. But also, one of the hallmarks of German diplomacy, if it may be termed that, is to hurry to rush other people into a contrived situation that they cannot get out of.
Mm-hmm.
Get them before they can think. The blitzkrieg mentality can be done with diplomacy.
Mm-hmm.
It can be done with money. It does not have to be with tanks and guns. That is, if other things fail, then you do it with tanks and guns. But for example, we have seen that Germany is forcing others to find things very rapidly. Let us go back to the Germans trying to enforce their own changes of law to make other nations turn back refugees so that they don't even get to the German border. So therefore, the German border begins at Bratislava. The German border begins east of Warsaw. The German border begins southeast of Vienna. This is a form of territorial expansion, and why the American press did not pick this up when it happened, I don't know. Central and Eastern European leaders are completely opposed to this. They called special meetings of their foreign ministers to say the following. And Alois Mock, the Austrian foreign minister, said explicitly, "We did not tear down an iron curtain only to help Germany erect an electronic curtain in its place."
And now again, the Germans...
They said that 2 weeks ago.
This is fascinating. The Germans are actually saying that their southern border is the Austrian border?
They are saying, in effect, that they did not say your border is our border. what is ours, what yours we shall negotiate. What they are saying is that we do not want any refugees to hit the German border.
And that means the Austrian border.
That means when they come out of Croatia or Slovenia or out of Italy or out of Hungary or out of Slovakia into Austria, at your border you turn them back, using our penal code, using our immigration laws. You turned them back for us.
And again, an eerie echo of the expansionism that we saw under Hitler.
It turns them into vassal states. It turns them into fiefdoms who are inferior to Bonn, and it takes their own freedom of choice away from them. They do that in technological development by removing their freedom of choice. If a German project approved by the Auswärtiges Amt, by the foreign ministry, is there, for example, there was a hydroelectric project in eastern Poland, and the money for it spent 10 years in Germany with drawing up of plans and blueprints. German companies flourished off this money that was counted officially as going to Poland for aid. What they had at the end of 10 years was no hydroelectric dams, but they had German blueprints. Now, this happened in Ghana. This happened in Slovakia. This happened in Hungary. This happens in the former Soviet Union, in Belarus, White Russia, in Russia, in Ukraine. It happens all over that the German figures on the amount of development aid they have given to other countries, it must be reduced by a very significant amount of money that stayed in Germany and never left the German economy. The contribution the Germans made to the Gulf War.
That was fascinating. We discussed that off the air, Billy. Could you briefly go into that for us? Because, of course, Americans got a tremendous...
You know, I apologize, because, Dave, I cannot remember what we discussed off the air because these are themes also that recently on a speaking tour I had been addressing some... I had been haranguing the crowds with some of these issues.
All righty.
And so I can't remember what I said to you and what I said to them.
Well, specifically...
However, if I did mention that to you, I think it is important as an example of how the German Entwicklungsbetrug, the development help fraud, is perpetuated. For example, the Germans are seeing now, as of the few days ago, they said in the Süddeutsche Zeitung of the 14th of March of this year, that the Germans believe that they have the right to determine some things because they paid $17 billion, not D-marks, but dollars, into the Gulf War against Saddam Hussein.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we have to reduce that amount by two factors. First, how much of that money was spent by German consulting firms studying feasibilities and making feasibility and test studies on how the money should be best spent. That is significant.
Mm-hmm.
Second, around $10 billion of that $17 billion was not cash at all. It was in the form of armaments of trucks and tanks and personnel carriers and technological weaponry that the West German government inherited when the walls came down and with the reunification.
Mm-hmm.
That weaponry is useless.
Why is that?
It was made to Warsaw Pact standards.
Mm-hmm.
A NATO troop can take a look at this, and unless they have special schooling in how to operate it, they wouldn't have a chance. They wouldn't know where to start, where to begin.
Mm-hmm.
They can perhaps get the truck started, and that's about it. And plus the fact that they take different octanes of gasoline, and some of them are two-cycle engines, which mix oil with gasoline, and the technology is entirely different. It was East German and Russian technology, Soviet technology to begin with. And unless the United Nations and American and French troops were specially schooled in how to use this, they couldn't use it. This takes months to teach a couple of 100,000 soldiers how to use this equipment. By that time, the war is over. The Germans knew this. So what they did is they took $10 billion worth of rusting equipment that they could not use, could not even sell to the third world. And therefore, it was sitting there useless. So they took lemons and turned it into a lemonade.
And
they placed it on a railroad siding. Many railroad sidings, I saw them myself. Ask anyone who lives in Hamburg, and they will tell you, yes, this stuff was on railroad sidings here for months. But while it was on railroad sidings, it was considered on an accrual accounting basis as already having been title ownership had been transferred, and therefore it was no longer on the German books. They had got it off their books, and therefore they had given $10 billion, even though the stuff never left Germany.
And so basically this was the aid that Germany gave to the Persian Gulf War,
was
this obsolete equipment which could not be used sitting on rail sidings.
Of around 65%.
Fascinating. And then there were also the feasibility studies that you alluded to earlier being
and
factored into
subtract,
the cost.
Then the other thing you have to bring into consideration, in order to help pay for the remainder of the $17 billion, they had the Bundesbank raise their interest rates by 0.25%, which then did terrible detriment and damage to everyone else's currencies all through Europe and put a strain on the pound sterling, on the French franc, on the Italian lira, on everybody else's currencies, and devalued other currencies by a percentage point in order to make up for that. So therefore, the German holdings, the D-mark itself, was more valuable, and that helped pay for the balance, the makeup. All told, by a combination of giving people used goods, plus their accrual accounting, plus their, let's say, manipulation of currency and interest rates, why, the project paid for itself, which is why they didn't feel it.
Fascinating. Fascinating. And,
Our point here is mm-hmm. that this is not a way to carry on a positive contribution to world peace. It has nothing to do with it. And this is the point that the American people should study in more detail. The other matter is that when back to the border situation of refugees, where they should be turned back
mm-hmm.
and who should be enforcing German law. For some years now, since the turn right of the mid-1980s, Germany has been demanding more and more vociferously the adoption of a European Penal Code, ein europäisches Strafgesetzbuch, or a criminal code, which adopts all the tenets of German criminal law in its present form. No other countries want this, but Germany wants it for them. And if you can imagine, with Germany losing its civil liberties and its sense of individual freedom day by day, this is not a very good investment for a foreign country to invest in their criminal code, which is why the linguistic and legal influence go hand in hand. If you can get them to buy your language, then you can get them to buy your lawyers and your legal code and your juridic system.
And
if you get them to buy your juridic system, then you get them to buy your database from your universities. If you get them to buy that, and that's the only chance they have for making money, then you shall have enslaved them forever.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons, in one of the white papers, I believe I gave you a copy, is that we feel in our consultancy that all developing countries, wherever they are, should have an opportunity to develop their educational systems on a social, on a sound, social, broad basis, which is in their own interest as well as the rest of the world, because it promotes stability. And this requires access and usage of the best and largest databases in technology. If they are limited only to a German database, then they will be viewing the world through German academic eyes, most of which is in translation from English. So why don't they eliminate the middleman and go to the English language to begin with? If it were not for translators, anyone who knows German literature and German publishing nowadays is in unanimous agreement that there would be no such thing as a German publishing business if it were not for translators. 8 out of 10 of the best sellers each week, as well as 6 or 7 out of 10 of the nonfiction works, are in translation from another language.
Fascinating. Fascinating.
The people who otherwise should be contributing to dissent and to venomous outspokenness on the German stage and in German literature, many of them are having such a hard time with their personal lives defending themselves against defamation and attack. Christa Wolf is one who she was a dynamic force for freedom in eastern Germany before the wall fell. Now where is she? In Santa Monica, California.
Really?
Yes. And this is continuing a long tradition of German anti-fascists who come to California. Bertolt Brecht did, Kurt Weill, any number of them, Thomas Mann.
Well, it certainly bodes well for the dissemination of anti-fascism in California, which I'm obviously very much involved in doing. Aside, it is very refreshing, Vili, to talk with you and to work with your consultants. I've been talking about...
Oh, by the way, talking of anecdotal evidence, because not all of this... Sometimes the anecdotal and the other coincide. One of the people in the Czech Interior Ministry, his name is Jiří Rummel, and I spoke with him not that long ago. He had gone to Bonn, Germany, to discuss this matter with several matters. First of all, that Daimler-Benz had started. Daimler-Benz, you know who they are.
Mm-hmm.
They make Mercedes, but they also make a good deal of armaments, and they make components for a number of other things, and they also manufacture trucks and so forth. Large corporation.
Mm-hmm.
They opened up offices and a factory to manufacture buses in what was then still Czechoslovakia. And then they no sooner had the ink dry on the contract, they asked... Now we assume that the government will close the door to any other manufacturers of cars and trucks to ensure that we have a monopoly here and for export. The Czechs were quite taken aback because they had come from near bankruptcy and they were trying to make something. And they're very clever people and very, very hardworking, the Czechs are. And I wish them every success in the world because they certainly deserve it. And these same people who had helped with the Prague Spring in 1968, and I was there at that time, and these same people were saying, no, we cannot do this. This is nowhere in the contract that we have to close our doors to other investments merely because one German firm is here. We won't do that. And so Daimler-Benz said, well, we can pull out just as easily. You know, we're not interested in sinking our money into a competitive situation. We do not compete with others. We tell others what to do. So it was very uncomfortable for a while. And the same thing happened to one of the few places where the Czech government actually exports to Germany, and that is in cement. Cement, concrete,
mm-hmm.
you know. And they, however, the Czechs, since the split with the Soviet Union, they no longer get so much oil in pipelines through the eastern part of the country out of Ukraine. So therefore, the Germans offered them, stop selling so much cement to West Germany and sell it cheaper and sell less of it so that we can protect our own cement industries, and then we will let you buy oil from us.
Interesting. One of the things that I want to get into later on in the discussion is the policies of German corporations. Their policy of excluding a foreign control of any German corporation, while at the same time
yes.
they're gaining control of corporations.
Well, they don't want foreigners to have control of their own countries and their own companies either. This is part of the problem. So Jiří Rommel went to Bonn to discuss these matters, and the Germans confronted him, and this was in February this year, around the 25th of February. They confronted him with a piece of paper they wanted him to sign, conceding that the Czech Republic would take care of enforcing German immigration law on its own borders. And so he refused to sign it, and he came back to Prague, and he was very angry. And the entire Czech government is still very angry about it. And this is why they went together with the Austrians, the Slovaks, and the Poles to call a meeting to find out what they should be doing about the German giant trying to tell them what to do with their everyday lives.
And now, where can people who would like to read about that find out? What are some of the journalistic sources for that?
The problem with that is this is in German. It is from the Süddeutsche Zeitung of the 28th of February of this year.
All righty. Okay. And again, that's one of the values of what you're doing. It's interesting, really, that you and your consultants I actually use the term anti-fascists to describe yourselves. I've been using that term to describe myself, and the reaction I get from the average American, frankly, is, well, when I talk about anti-fascism, their reaction is, well, I never knew her personally, but I hear she was quite a gal. And I'm afraid the time has come for people to recognize that fascism is indeed on the rebound or even becoming triumphant. And once again, we should take care to emphasize that this broadcast should not be interpreted as being anti-German, but rather it's anti-fascist, and the resurgence of fascism is not just taking place in Germany, but obviously it is taking place in Germany in a big way. It's not just skinheads rioting in the street, but it is...
I think one of the points that we have to discuss is that wherever there is a situation of upheaval and rapid change,
mm-hmm.
There will be fascism waiting to step into the vacuum. Wherever there is a situation such as in Central and Eastern Europe that there is the beginnings of democracy, of free market economies, in whatever form they finally take, that is up to the people themselves, but it should not be dictated by fascism.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is that fascism is a flawed form of government because it appears successful at the first, at the outset, because of its supreme concentration of powers and forced collaboration of many, many sectors of society and industry. But on the long run, it is terrible because it is short-sighted, it is inflexible, it is patently unfair, and discriminates against the weaker segments of society as part of its very definition. And therefore, when we see these things coming together, we don't care what they call themselves. It don't look to what they say, but what they do,
mm-hmm.
which is why we don't concentrate in our consultancy very much on the skinheads, because we consider them only those unfortunate, envious, uneducated, discriminated, youthful people who don't have a chance of upward mobility in their own society. And therefore, fascism is waiting with open arms. It does that in any country, and
mm-hmm.
This is why we also say that Germany is more advanced in its development of fascism in its present state than are its neighbors, but because Germany is larger and is richer and more important for that reason, because it has recent power and growing power, then it is important to analyze it there and find out another question then, which will be the next logical question: what effect does this have on the United States?
We will be dealing with German policy vis-a-vis America later on in the broadcast. One point I wanted to go into again, Willy, I did not understand all of the aspects of it, and it appears important with regard to German economic imperialism in Europe and elsewhere. But the fudging of aid figures, foreign aid figures for Germany, and how supposed plants and institutions which have been built actually are simply German blueprints. Could you go into that again? Because that would appear to me to be setting the stage for later German economic imperialism.
It perhaps was not originally intended as economic imperialism. It was intended to give the Germans a good image. They're very worried about a good image because they have had bad images twice in this century.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, they try to create the impression outwardly that there is a happy face on everything, that they are giving more in foreign aid than anyone else, that they are giving more to the United Nations than anyone else, that they gave more to the Gulf War, that they give, and they open their pockets and their purses and their checkbooks constantly and are the most generous people on earth. The fact is, this is not true generally. And whether or not we give 5 examples, as we already have, or 5,000 examples, which would only take longer, but would not prove a different point. The point is that they fudge not only on the amounts of money, but in the type and the way it is spent. Some years ago, in 1985, Chancellor Kohl said, what we want for Germany to be is Blaupausenland. We want to be the blueprint country. So that we are the people who originate the ideas, we are on the cutting edge of change and progress, and therefore we will pay money that our development aid will have to take this into consideration, that if you want to build dams, then get the Americans to actually bring a bulldozer and people with shovels, and they know how to do that, but they should do it according to German specifications, because the Germans are a little bit better at this, actually.
All righty. One of the things that we were talking about vis-a-vis German aid to the Persian Gulf War and how actually a lot of it was obsolete and unusable equipment from the former Warsaw Pact military alliance that had basically sat rusting on the rail sidings in Hamburg, one of the things that I would like to talk about, and I think we should go into this perhaps after a musical break to give the audience a chance to rest up and us as well, and that is the fascinating and very terrifying maneuvering that has taken place from Germany with regard to Swedish participation on the UN Security Council.
Oh, yes. That is a chapter in itself, and so well documented, I would look forward to that one, because that's a much easier thing to organize, because it contains fewer people and more malevolence.
and it's in particular German policy vis-a-vis the United Nations, and some remarkable statements by a couple of Luftwaffe generals that you relayed to me. These things bode very poorly, not only for the future of Europe, but for the great giant here, the United States, as well, because this has grave implications for the future, it seems to me, from what you've told me, Willy, of the German-American relations as well. But let's take a break now. I'm going to play a little music, give the audience a chance to stretch and relax and refresh their powers of concentration, and I can give an ID, and we can do the same. I'm going to put you on hold, Willy, and then we will come back after 5-10 minutes or so, and we will pick up the situation of Sweden and the UN Security Council and how Germany has been maneuvering in that regard.
Vielen Dank.
Okay, very good. All righty, once again, we will come back after a musical break, and we will hear more from Wilhelm Stauffer of Stauffer Consultants, again, a pseudonym, and we will hear about some things that we have not been hearing about here in the United States, and they are very, very important.